Okay, well, good morning again. Thank you all for praying for me. I'm still struggling a bit, but with some changes in the way I'm doing things and painkillers, I've been managing to keep my headache under control. God said His grace is sufficient for us. His strength is made perfect in our weakness. Okay, there's a lot of going back and forth. Well, just one thing I was wanting to remark about Mark's, I myself did not have that ideal coming to the marriage altar, as he talked about. And I'm not going to go on all that. There's some things that I think we just need to let in the past. But one thing I want to say about that is, you know, in those years, I think we're filling ourselves with something. I never felt an emptiness in that sense that I was trying to fill, but that's exactly what I was doing. And those relationships, boy-girl relationships, they do that. They fill us with something that's not real, when we should be filling ourselves with the Word of God. And okay, somebody asked me yesterday after I got done where Anglican comes from. I did a little research on that. The word Anglican is from a Latin word. It was Ecclesia Anglicana or something like that. It means English church, basically. So that's where the word Anglican comes from. Today, I'm going to be focusing on the Anabaptist and non-resistant groups in Pennsylvania at the time of the Revolution, just a little bit to try to get some idea of how God's kingdom and the world's kingdom was operating together or existing in the same space, if you will. And it's not inconceivable. I mean, we think that it could never happen, and it may not. But it's not inconceivable that we could again face a civil war. At that time, it didn't seem possible to them either. And with the recent development of the polarity there in the rhetoric there in Washington, it could happen. It doesn't. James talks about that. And where do wars come from? And I just want to go over this. It's going to be more reading out of books than I like to do usually. But this book here, this Twas Seeding Time, is where I'm getting most of my information today. And it's not written in a way that's easy to just take a part out of it. It's written, it follows the lives of men through the whole thing. So it's woven throughout the story. It's really hard to just take a paragraph and just read it. So it's going to be a little more scattered. I hope it's also going to be a little shorter. And if you want to know more, you can read the book. I tried to find a simple map of Pennsylvania at that time. I couldn't do it. I know that some of you here probably, especially some of the older ones, know much more about Pennsylvania, though I was born there and lived there for the first 4 or 5 years of my life. I wouldn't raise there. So I don't, some of these places are just places to me. Okay, one big difference. I might come across that here just a little bit. I might just say that right now. One big difference between the non-resistant people, which at that time, the time we're talking about now, included the Quakers and some of the Lutherans and the Anabaptists and then the Dunkers. They were all part of the non-resistant groups there. But one big difference in the theology they had was, it's in this book here, Pilgrims and Politics, and I want to read it. It says, I'll just say, the Revolution strengthened the Anabaptist understanding the world is no friend to grace. The Anabaptists believe that in Romans 13:1, the powers that be are any political powers under which Christians find themselves. They appreciated benevolent governments, but for most of their history, they had not experienced this blessing. Nevertheless, they believed that they should respect and obey any government, regardless of how it treated them, unless doing so violated a New Testament command. And that's still how we believe. The beliefs of the early American Protestants were this: the powers that could be could refer only to powers that were just and fair. How could any power claim to be ordained of God if it did not act right? That was simple, straightforward reasoning, so simple that it entirely overlooked the nature of all the governments under which the New Testament scriptures had been written. So that was a big difference in the early thinking. All right, conditions in Pennsylvania. If you all know there's two things that most of us probably know because of the books we read when we grew up. One is we know the poem, The Unbarred Door. Or most of us know snippets of that. That was took place probably, if it's even a true account, that was probably on that in the Pennsylvania frontier. The other story that most of us know is the story of the Jacob Hostetler family. That they were a family that had moved out west, away from the eastern settlements, and where the Indians were right across the Blue Ridge Mountains there. The Hostetler family was within about, or Hostetler, I'm not sure how they said it, but it's about 3 miles from the mountains there. And they were the dad was non-resistant. And one night they were attacked, and they, contrary to the story that I read, or the story that I read here and the one that I grew up with, it don't quite agree, but they managed to fight the fire and then escape, but the Indians captured them and killed the mother and the daughter and Jacob Jr., who had been shot in the leg earlier. But one thing that had happened there, the boys were ready to fight, and Joseph Hostetler always said after they were about 6 years later, they were either returned or traded or something. Most of them returned to their people. But he always maintained that they could have fought off the Indians if their father would have allowed them to shoot. So that was some things that were happening there on the western frontier of Pennsylvania. We're going to be talking more of the eastern part. Okay, the Anabaptists, while glad for freedom and a chance to spread their wings outside of the Swiss valleys, they still felt like a people apart. In 1754, when the war seemed probable with the French — this was a French and Indian war, I touched on it briefly yesterday — the French, by the way, had no interest really in settling the United States. And that's why the Indians were glad to join them in this fight, because the French saw this as a vast natural resource for furs. They were very much interested in that way. So the Indians joined with the French and fought against the British and the settlers there. While this was happening, the settlers all of a sudden realized, the non-resistant settlers all of a sudden realized that they had signed a paper promising King George that they would fight for him in the event that the country was attacked. And they hadn't realized it because most of them could not speak or read English. And they became very alarmed about this, and they appealed to the government to be considerate of their situation. And Benjamin Franklin said that they had hoped to be the quiet in the land, and if the French took over, they didn't see much difference. They were willing to live under the French just as sure as they were under the English. But they recognized the biblical distinction between the church and the world. They did not feel like they lived in Christian colonies. In fact, they often felt like aliens among the English and Irish settlers, which were the Scot-Irish, where there was a large number of Scot-Irish in Pennsylvania. They would have been Presbyterian, and they were very warlike. I'm not going to go into that today, but they committed some terrible atrocities against peaceful Indians. In 1727, Governor Patrick Gordon wrote this about these strangers, as he called them: "Being ignorant of our language and laws, and settling in a body together, make as it were a distinct people." That's what we want to be, right? But after observing them for over a year, he said this: "They have behaved themselves well and have generally so good a character for honesty and industry as deserve the esteem of this government." And this wasn't just, I'm not sure where the Quakers fit. Like I told somebody today, if you ask me very many questions about this subject, I'm able to answer them. because I'm had to focus on kind of what I'm going through here and my focus rather than. So I'm just going to say I don't really know where the Quakers came from. I know of the Quakers. I know kind of a part they played there, but they were also considered part of this group. They would have been non-resistant. In 1727, the Mennonites wrote a letter to the Pennsylvania public explaining their relationship to the world like this. And this was in response to the realization that they had signed something they did not agree with. They said, "It behooves and becomes a right and true Christian that he should be little and low in the world and shun greatness of the same and keep himself like the lowly ones." And this letter was written 50 years before the Revolution, and it just shows that the Mennonites, it wasn't just at the Revolutionary War that they became estranged with their surroundings. This had already been, from the time they settled there, they realized that their values don't line up with the values of those around them. They did not consider themselves part of mainstream colonial America. And then later on, an Episcopalian minister in Maryland named William Duke wrote about the Washington County, Maryland Mennonites. He said they had a scheme of discipline that clashes with the common methods of government and civil society. Yet these people, he said, do not intentionally cause disturbance or innovation, and they are remarkably peaceful and passive, and therefore are readily tolerated and excused. But as the clouds of war gathered on the horizon, the divide between the non-resistant folks and the other groups widened and became more evident. And that's what we're going to talk about mostly today. In Lancaster County, there was a Presbyterian minister named John Carmichael who preached that non-resistance was foolish. Had not God created all the animals with defense, hooves, teeth, claws? And he said, men are no different. God created with means of defense. Of course, he's added, a Christian must be sure that he conducts his warfare in a righteous way and that his cause is just. If it is, Christ has no problem with his people going to war. In fact, he emphasized all the angels of heaven were supporting the patriots because truth and justice were on their side. And it's, you know, we look at this and we think this, you know, they're way off base. But the problem is, if we're not careful, and we'll hear some about this a little bit later on, if we're not careful, we can get ourselves in a position where what we say in church and what we say in public are very contradictory. The Anabaptists and other non-resistant groups watched all this in amazement. What kind of God would agree that it was a sacred duty to break agreements and fight the powers that be, the agreement they had with the English government? What kind of honor could cause a people to burn and bury English lords and tax collectors in effigy? And if you know what that means, they made these cutouts, but they looked like tax collectors and English lords, and then they would bury them or burn them. Based on how the patriots were acting, the Anabaptists wondered whether this new government would provide the same peace and liberty they had had under the English. In 1775, Bishop, this was just before the Declaration, Bishop Benjamin Hershey composed a letter on behalf of Mennonites and Brethren, a statement for the assembly written in German, translated into English, and signed by ministers of both groups. This would have been the Mennonites and the Brethren, or the Dunkers, I believe. It was presented to the House and titled A Short and Sincere Declaration to Our Honorable Assembly. This was the House, it says to the House. This was actually not the English rule anymore, but the colonial rule. He begins by acknowledging the goodness and love of God revealed to mankind in Jesus Christ. Further, he thanked the Assembly for continuing to allow for liberty of conscience to those that cannot bear arms. Every favor and leniency the Assembly may show towards the least of Christ's brethren, among whom the defenseless Christians by his grace hope to be ranked, will not be forgotten in the day of judgment, he said. He goes on to say, with cheerfulness we receive the Assembly's advice to aid those who are distressed. it being our principle to feed the hungry and give the thirsty drink. Further, we have dedicated ourselves to serve all men in everything that can be helpful for the preservation of man's lives. But we find no freedom in giving or doing or assisting in anything by which men's lives are destroyed or hurt. We beg the patience of all those who believe we err on this point. He ends the letter by humbly stating the utter impossibility of taking up arms to conquer our enemies. Mennonites will rather, he writes, pray to God who has power in heaven and on earth for us and them. We are always ready to pay taxes and to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's and unto God those things that are God's. And this letter was in response to the increasing pressure from radicals that the non-resistant people would pay money to support those others that were fighting. One signer of this letter was a man named Claus Rittenhouse. He was a Mennonite minister as well. And the reason I just mentioned that name specifically is because the name Rittenhouse is one we'll come across later. Okay, one of the earlier battles of the Revolution was known as Bunker Hill, and that battle put the bellows in that battle, the American forces were defeated. But the British lost something like 1,000 men, and they began to realize that they have the power and ability to force the British to retreat. So it put the bellows of flames to the flames of the war spirit. One Mennonite wrote at that time, "It is almost impossible to describe the fervor for preservation of liberty which is now burning in North America. Everyone has taken up arms. Even the smallest lads organized companies and conducted military drills." And just to picture what was happening there in that time. The more the militia drilled, the heavier grew the pressure on the non-resistant people to pay. And earlier, the Pennsylvania Assembly had decided that those who wouldn't go to war would have to pay £3.10. And I don't know if any of you know what the equivalent is. I'm not used to thinking in pounds and shillings, but it was a fairly good sized amount. But the thing was, it was voluntary. It was a fine, but it wasn't classed as a tax. And unless they chose to enforce it, you could just get by without paying it. And the Mennonites, pretty much as a whole, saw it as a direct link to the war effort, and they would not pay it. So those are some of the things that they were wrestling with at the time. You know, should we pay it, should we not? While they believe in paying their taxes, is this government a legitimate government? Who's the government we're loyal to? We promised King George that we're loyal to him. We'd pay our taxes. Who are we loyal to? This was things that they were wrestling with as churches. And again, it's just something that we ourselves have never faced. But we might, and it just emphasizes it. I thought the other thing, this session here is called Pilgrim Politics, but it could very well have been called the Two Kingdoms. It emphasizes the values of the two kingdoms. Now, there was one exception to this agreement among the Mennonites, and that was Bishop Christian Funk. He believed that they could pay those £3.10 and just acknowledge the authority of the new political arrangement. Christian Funk, it seems from all that I could read, was he was more involved in politics than he probably should have been, which you could say for probably some of us as well. He was thinking ahead of what was going to happen if this government actually was victorious. He said they'd already taken the Continental money and paid their debts with it. What had happened to the Americans, if you want to call them that, they were printing money to get away from the British pound. And it was basically an act of rebellion there. And what he said was they were already using that money, though it wasn't worth. You ever heard the expression, not worth a continental? That's where it comes from. Their money wasn't worth much. There was nothing to back it up. All right, this issue continued to fester, this issue of whether to pay this tax or not, or this fine, continued to fester in the Franconia Mennonite Church for many years, and eventually it led to the silencing of Bishop Funk. And it became so severe in the end, and I'm not sure if I got this later in my notes or not, but in the end, what happened was it split the church. over this issue. And the bishop, there was another bishop just that was Bishop Funk's neighbor named Jacob Oberholzer. And they died being unreconciled to each other, though they had tried for many years. Christian Funk had tried for many years to be reconciled, even after they had silenced him. But it split the church, and this is just a warning to us that if we allow ourselves to become involved in politics, it can have a big impact on brotherhood. As this new polarization spread to Pennsylvania's backcountry, defenseless Christians regarded it. Now, I'm switching gears again here. I'm probably getting y'all confused. This polarization I'm talking about now is between the Americas and the British government. At first, the Christians regarded it as just an otherworldly attitude from which they must stay aloof. But their military-minded neighbors soon demanded confrontation or silence. And you and I both know that our values do not agree with most of our neighbors' values. And right now, we can all live together in peace, and we're friends, and we'll help each other out. And, yeah, I was at a funeral of a neighbor here not that long ago, that I really enjoyed being around him. But the thing is, our values are different. And once that conflict started, it brought this into focus. And now you had to declare your loyalties. One young Mennonite man learned to keep his mouth shut. He had been helping at a frolic. And there was a local tavern owner that was also part of the militia. He came around and said, every able-bodied man at this frolic has got to register and be in this company and start to drill and all that. And this Mennonite youth just spoke up, and he advised against such warlike behavior and said that it would lead to something that they regret later on. And this man, this tavern owner, got very upset about this, and he took this, he got a warrant for this young fella, and he took him in front of the council, and the council was called the Committee of Observation, and they asked him, if he had anything to say for himself. And he said that he hadn't considered his comments to have been injurious to anyone in intent or effect. That was not his purpose. He was just, I just spoke his mind. And the committee consulted briefly, and he was sentenced to be tarred and feathered. That was a favorite way of dealing with those that they considered disloyal to the Patriots. They would smear or dump tar over them, and then they would just take a bunch of feathers or a pillow that was filled with feathers and just, just tar and feather them. And a lot of times then they would put them on a wagon or a rail or something, and they'd take them out of town just as a real sign of derision there. But that was his sentence, to be tarred and feathered, and someone had already put a tar box there in front of the courthouse, and one boy had brought along some stuffed pillow, and they were going to have a good time with this. And the Mennonite came, and the young Mennonite man stood there beside the tar box that had been ordered, and nobody would come and put the tar on him. And there were some bystanders that concluded that the committee members were ashamed of what was happening there. And finally, there was a man there that wasn't quite as charitable, and he told the young boy to start putting it on himself. So he said the young man immediately took his jacket and shirt off and started daubing tar on himself. And anyway, then finally someone in the crowd told the young man to go home. And so he picked up his jacket and shirt and went home. But they began to learn to keep their thoughts to themselves a little bit. But those were things that happened. There's some more incidents. I'm not going to go over them. But too many at that time still felt, even just local people that had no profession of non-resistance, still felt the war's foolishness and something like this is beneath them to be really serious about tarring and feathering this young man. But elsewhere, the Lancaster men, the resistant people, were being called up to march and drill. The Mennonites were still trying to live their lives. They're farming there in the middle, or I'd say Mennonites. They were more than Mennonites. And they were still trying to live their lives there. Some lived in town and had businesses. But there's some ironies in this war that I'll point out. The men of Lancaster County, when they were drilling to whip them in shape for battle, there was also training for shooting. But the thing was, most of them didn't need that training. Most of them were expert shots already. But one of the ironies of the Revolutionary War was this, that the Pennsylvania men had use of a rifle called the Kentucky Rifle. And I remember being so enamored with that one there. I bought one like that one day. But anyway, what I was going to say about that is that the rifle was the most accurate, deadly rifle that had ever been invented or improved. They improved some other guns. And the ironies of that was, it was a Mennonite man that had come up with that design. And it says, in the hands of his militant American neighbors, became the most fatal widow and orphan maker in the world. Another tragic incident happened when the soldiers of the Continental Army were looking for wadding. If you know what wadding was, they'd put their powder in and they'd put their bullet in, and then in the old muzzle loaders, and then they'd put their wadding in to hold the bullet in place. And they'd pack that down in there so that when the powder exploded, it would create force for that bullet to fly out. That was what they were looking for. They couldn't find it. Usually they'd use little pieces of oiled cloth, but they'd run out all this, and they were looking for anything that they could hold in. And they're looking for paper, and they arrived at the Effort of Cloister in Lancaster County looking for paper for their wadding. And they found several hundred unbound copies of the Martyr's Mirror. The Martyr's Mirror had first been, if I'm not wrong, the Martyr's Mirror had first been printed in English here in America. Okay. From Dutch to German. Okay. Whatever the case, they had some unbound copies there, and that hadn't been bound and sold yet. And they had considered at first to put up a fight, but in the end they surrendered. They surrendered the paper. And it says, undoubtedly, even the title page bearing the words, "The Bloody Drama of the Defenseless Christians," served to hold in place the bullets which shed the blood of British and Hessian soldiers. So those are some of the tragic ironies of that war. Okay, in Franconia, the militia company elected John Cope as their captain. These are just names. These names mean nothing to me or you. They're just men that have served their time and have died and gone to the reward. His reformed relatives were enthusiastic patriots, but the bulk of Franconia was Mennonite, and his company tended to be thin. Those who did not respond when the troops were called up to duty were now legally required, as David Rittenhouse, remember that name Rittenhouse, had wished, to pay substitute fine. It was no longer a contribution, but an effect tax. Now it no longer became optional to pay your fine. You had to pay it now. So many men were unwilling to drill or serve that by the end of 6 months, the colonel had collected the astounding sum of £10,000 from fines alone. The cost of the war was now felt by all families, and the issue whether to pay or not to pay became unavoidable. They forced him to pay. Now, I'm going to read you just a little bit this Rittenhouse. I had never heard the name before I had been studying for this. But Claus Rittenhouse had signed that original letter that I read parts of from 1727. That was in 1775, I think. But David Rittenhouse's father, which would have been Claus Rittenhouse's son, had married a Quaker girl and had moved into town, I believe. And David himself was very gifted. He had done amazing things in science. And anyway, he became involved in this whole thing. And his grandfather had signed the letter that included words like this: "One of the weightiest articles of our doctrine of religion is that without any worldly might or fleshly defense and weapons, the Lord Christ must be preached and followed revengeless. The basic content of this teaching is that we desire to be hurtful to none, but to be profitable and helpful to all people. And David Rittenhouse himself, I'm sorry, I'm getting some things. With their life's blood, David Rittenhouse Mennonite forebears had paid for their loyalty to his kingdom, Christ's kingdom. But now, as an American statesman, he had taken up the language of a tradition which, while it contained enlightened aspects of the modern age, was wedded to the ancient belief that the sword must be the final arbiter in the most difficult human disputes. Thus, the grandson of a Mennonite had made the request. This is talking about, okay, let me back up now. I'm going to lose you here if I'm not careful. This request that they would be forced to pay the fine. David Rittenhouse was directly responsible in forcing his non-resistant relatives to pay this fine. Thus, the grandson of a Mennonite had made the request, and a Quaker had recorded the response of the government that would require their conscientious relatives to pay the fruit of their labors to support the military resolution of a cause they rejected. And I just want to bring it out because this is something that happened over and over, where some of the younger generation joined the patriot cause. There was actually one of the Mennonites wrote a poem in the Philadelphia newspaper that said this. It was titled, "To David Rittenhouse, meddle not with state affairs, keep acquaintance with the stars. Science, David, is thy line. Warp not nature's great design if thou to fame would rise." Okay, we'll go on there. Some of the newly appointed officers felt a personal anger towards those who were not enthusiastic for the patriot cause. And in June of 1777, they received a tool from the Pennsylvania Assembly that allowed them to vent their anger. The Pennsylvania Assembly adopted an act called the Test Act, obliging the male white inhabitants of this state to give assurance of allegiance to their new government. This was to be done before the first day of August. So in June, this was passed. In August, it was expected that they would have to do this. And it was intended to expose once and for all those who had withheld their service and allegiance from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. It was time to make everyone admit that the colony was now independent of the king. They would need to renounce and refuse all allegiance to the King of Great Britain. He must also report all treason and traitorous conspiracies against the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Those who refused to take the oath could not vote or travel more than a mile from their home. They could not buy or sell or transfer property. And that was another thing that David Rittenhouse pushed, that this would be made to stick. Later on, this test included, if they wouldn't take the oath, punishment of having all their goods sold, and they would be banished from the state of Pennsylvania. So this is some of the things they were facing there. And I'm going to read just a few sentences out of the book here about this, ones that were not willing to take this test. One elderly Quaker miller from Upper Marion Township was hanged. Despite a petition signed by 4,000 people and also a farmer from Hatfield Township, before the latter was executed, several of his Mennonite neighbors with a number of Welsh Quakers signed a fruitless petition for his pardon, citing the plight of his wife and several small children. Many confiscations of property and real estate took place as officials eager to settle old scores and collect a percentage of the price brought by the sheriff's auctions did their work. And also here's some things. The Mennonites really had you can imagine there was really a problem deciding what was right, because the army was demanding their horses and wagons, and they didn't. I'll say this: it doesn't seem that they took joyfully the spoiling of their goods. I'll say that, but. But they had to decide what to do, and they often sent their boys along to make sure the horse and wagon got back home. And so there was just there were all these decisions that they had to make to figure out what was right, what was proper. And I say that because I'm going to read something here, and I'm going to still break in here. In their community, with the apparent allowance of their bishop, Jacob Meyer, they had paid both taxes and fines to the new government, furnished horses and teams for the continental service whenever demanded, and occasionally gone along with their teams as drivers. But because they would not take the oath, they had everything sold out from under them, including the stoves that were bolted to the floor of their houses. And in some cases, they were driven even from the state. So those were some of the punishments for not taking that oath. And this was, some of this pressure came from the grandson of a Mennonite minister. And then one replied, Christopher Sauer, I believe it was, that when they asked him why he was so opposed to taking his oath, his reason was this. He said, you have in your act that they that do not take that oath shall not have a right to buy nor sell. This was so close to the prediction in the book of Revelation of an evil mark of the beast that Christian said he could not take that oath while it stood on that condition. That was one reason. Others took it because they saw it as... I don't think they had to swear. I think they could affirm that they would support the new government. Others felt like their government was King George, and for that reason they wouldn't do it. The country was often ransacked. They went, Washington, says General Washington was appalled by the way his soldiers acted. But in the next breath, he had to order them to go to the houses and take things because his soldiers were starving. But here's one interesting thing. They would strip, they would literally strip when they traveled to the countryside. When they left, there was nothing left usually except the standing grain. There was, at that point, yet the furniture would be what I'm talking about as far as livestock. There was no, the cows were gone, the sheep were gone, the hens were gone, everything was gone. And this is a story here. This was a Christmas Day foraging party, and this was, I think, the British. And they came, here's the other thing. The British were either just across the river from Philadelphia, later on they were in Philadelphia, so you had the British coming out, taking from the people, and then the Continental Army, too. But this is kind of an amusing story. The wife of Amishman Christian Zook, who lives several miles west of Valley Forge, was visited by American soldiers just as she took her family's bread out of the oven, all of which they confiscated except one loaf, which she was said to have wrapped in her apron, crying, "This one's for me." They let her have it. They took everything else. But it became a daily way of life. It was almost impossible to continue life as normal. But the other thing that caused great conflict and punishment to the people of the non-resistant people was they took their food and their goods to Philadelphia to sell, where the British would give them gold and silver, and instead of the continental money. And this became illegal, according to the assembly in new American government, which wasn't much of a government at the time. But so this was, I'm just going to read here a little bit of what was happening there. They were sneaking through and taking they didn't trust the money from the continental government, and they wanted the gold and silver, and they took their, they still felt loyal to the King George, and they took their things up to Philadelphia, or down or over. They've been to the west, they've been going east, or somewhere just to the north. Anyway, for this is some of the punishments they received. For sneaking cattle into Philadelphia, one man received 250 lashes on his back, well laid on. Another had all his property confiscated while he went to jail. Carrying flour to the city earned Philip Colt 50 lashes and employment in public work while the British Army continues in this state. This was by the Continental Army that was doing this. Before long, the whippings became so common and so fierce that a surgeon was appointed to stand by, who stopped several whippings because the culprit could stand no more. One Mennonite farmer who, according to a story told by his family in later years, did get into Philadelphia with his produce. He was considered a possible spy by the British and locked up. So he got in there, and then the British thought he was a spy. All during the night, Abram Hunsberger sang hymns undauntedly, and the mornings his captors released him as harmless. So those were some of the things that were happening. And the other thing that was happening there, not all of the people in the countryside were non-resistant, and they kept complaining to the generals about their soldiers coming out. And one of the generals shouldn't have said this, but he said, I'm not going to say the words he used, but he said, well, shoot him. And he said, why don't you shoot him? And unfortunately, what happened was the guy did just that. And the next time soldiers came around, he shot them. And he was arrested. And he escaped with his life by proving that the general had actually told him to do that. But so there was a lot of turmoil going on there. Another thing that happened was just humiliation. There was one that the General John Lacey instructed his scouting parties, if they saw anybody taking food to Philadelphia, just shoot him and let him lay right in the road. But one thing they did that wasn't carried out right away, but there was a man taking some eggs to market, and they caught him, and they just humiliated him. They a dozen soldiers tied him to a tree, and then they took the eggs and just threw all his eggs at him. I mean, it was better than being shot, but it was just it just gives you an idea of what they were suffering through that time. Okay, so here's a question that some historians have had. Why did they refuse to sell their things to the Continental Army? One reason I already mentioned was the money. But another thing that they saw, and I'm not sure how we'd look at this today, but they saw this. They saw that there would be no resolution, or they looked beyond the squabbles of the government and of men that claimed there was no resolution but powder and shot. And they saw that the suffering soldiers of Valley Forge were there by their own choice. That's the way they looked at it. Whether right or wrong, I'm not going to say. They looked at it. They said that men choose to wage wars. And he said, Bishop Benjamin Hershey said this, if it were a matter of helping the poor and oppressed, the Mennonites were ready and willing. We have dedicated ourselves to such work. But to supply the food so that someone else was allowed to leave his own fields for the purpose of shedding his enemy's blood was another matter entirely. So that's the opinion they had. That was one reason they would not sell their food to the army. Some of the decisions they were trying to make. Okay, there's a couple more stories. The book is full of stories, but I'm just trying to pick some out of each situation that they were facing there. But there's one very touching story in here then, but so I can find it here, 136. I had to number my pages so I know where to find these. There'd been a battle in Germantown, I think, and General Nash had received a shrapnel or bullet wound to the leg, and he died of it later. Now, General Nash, I know nothing of the man, but Nashville was named after General Nash. I think he came from Tennessee. Nashville had not been founded yet at that time. But he died, in a Mennonite's home or somewhere close, right there in the Mennonite community. He was buried with full military honors in the middle of the Mennonite cemetery. And there were others buried in that same cemetery. And John Roos says here that I guess even now, even to this day, this would have been in the 70s, I think. But he said that every year, every spring, there are these patriotic organizations that go out and put flags on all the tombstones of the soldiers. And he said in that, I think it's in that cemetery, there are tombstones that have the United States flag on them that were actually the Mennonites that were non-resistant. And he, at one time, I went out, I think, and removed some of the flags, though the author of this book himself, I don't think, is very non-political, or I don't know if he's even non-resistant. But it was just one of those ironies of the war that that the general was buried in a non-resistant cemetery. But here's a touching story. It's about a wedding, and Deacon Henry Rosenberg's family, they're celebrating the wedding of his daughter Magdalena to his indentured servant John Swartley. John has had to pay considerable fines to stay clear of the militia. This is his happy day. The harvest is in, it is wedding season, and the sumptuous meal is nearly prepared. But there are unexpected guests. The inevitable foragers have come across the rise from Tawamenkin, seeking supplies for the army. The women consult in consternation. They agree on a plan. They invite the soldiers to sit down with the guests. There's friendship and respect in the midst of the chaos of war, and the soldiers, having drunk to the health of newlyweds, leave without taking so much as a chicken. So there's some stories that show what, you know, what just respect and, you know, just simple love can do there. And many more stories. One other story I want to relate is about Pastor Muhlenberg. He was a Lutheran pastor, and he kept himself distant from the war. He looked at it with suspicion. I don't know if his beliefs were non-resistant or not, but he himself definitely was not okay with the war. His son, John Peter, was also a pastor. And he wrote this. This is a son. I'm a clergyman, it is true, but I'm a member of society as well, and my liberty is as dear to me as any man. And then I'll skip some of the rest of what he said there. But in Sunday morning, he was preaching on the third chapter of Ecclesiastes, which states that there's a proper time for everything. And then in the end, he says, and there's a time to fight. And he throws back his robe, and he has a uniform of a military officer on. And on the spot, it says that he enlisted most of the able-bodied men in his congregation. And it wasn't just happening in the Lutheran church. The Quakers lost a lot of, they lost a lot of their non-resistance. There, a lot of their people went to fight, and the Mennonites as well. There are more stories of the abuses they suffered. One was after the war was winding down. There were a lot of British prisoners, and because of lack of housing and lack of a lot of things, some of these prisoners escaped and roamed the country, and the non-resistant folks gave them shelter, just like they would the other side. And for that, I think there was an elderly couple, a 70-year-old woman, I believe, that was she was sentenced to be whipped. I think I forget how many lashes, but they but there were some that kept that from happening. But it was the times there. They were very trying, and we don't think of them a lot. So I just want to read this again. I read this the other day, but I just want to read this again because it's speaking about this very time here. By failing to remember this part of their own story, even conservative Mennonites allow a vacuum in their identity into which can gradually creep the myth of a God-ordained United States born from the matrix of the Revolutionary War. Okay, so that's all I have today. Just trying to give a really quick picture of what was happening there. Tomorrow, we hope to get into some more practical areas of how it's affecting us today.